following is a recording for the press office of the Israel Project on Monday, May 1st, 2017 at 1:30 p.m. Central Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we will take questions through email. I would now like to turn the conference over to Omri Sarin. You may begin.
Thank you for that. Thank you all for joining us today on an increasingly busy news cycle, it looks like, and thank you especially to Ambassador Roth for joining us to have today's discussion. As all of you know, Mahmoud Abbas is going to be coming into town for his first meeting with President Trump, and that comes on the heels of meetings between the Americans and the Israelis, as well as a flurry of speculation and so on about the plans that the current administration has regarding Middle East negotiations, as well as a trip by the President of the Middle East to kind of do a curtain raise on this and set the stage both for this week's meeting and for what's likely to occur in the coming weeks and months. We have today Ambassador Roth, who of course served in four successive administrations, ran point on the peace process. He's now at the Washington Institute and is the author of a book that's directly relevant to the background context and possible trajectory of peace talks, which is doomed to succeed, of course. And he will deliver some opening remarks, and then we have questions that we've gotten by email. You can email questions at any time during the call at events@theisraelproject.org, events@theisraelproject.org. And we will take them as they come in. If we don't get to them, then we'll connect you to people who can help after the call. On that note, I'll turn it over to Ambassador Roth.
Okay, thank you. You know, I think the I'll speak for a little bit just to set a context, and then we'll look forward to your questions. Abbas is coming, and he's coming in a way where the president, in some ways, has already added to his relevancy by inviting him to come. I say that because if you look at Abbas's position in the region, it had really been weakened. He really did not have good relations with President Sisi, Abdullah, or with the Gulf states, and yet both Sisi and Abdullah, after it became clear that he was invited to see President Trump, then agreed to see him. So, interestingly enough, what the president has done is make him more relevant again, which is important at a time when he does not have a lot of popularity within the Palestinian Authority, but he has moved by creating something called the General Conference of Fatah. He moved at the end of last year to consolidate his hold over all the instrumentalities of power in the Palestinian Authority. So on the one hand, he is sort of more in control of the instruments of power within the Palestinian Authority. On the other hand, his popularity is at a pretty all-time low. And he's being challenged by Marwan Barghouti at this point, who, at the very time when he was coming to Washington, Marwan Barghouti launched a hunger strike among the Fatah prisoners. About two-thirds of the Fatah prisoners are actually taking part in it. So the setting is he's coming, and I think he wants to show that he remains a pivotal player. He is, I think, trying to focus on getting away with doing the minimum in response to the president. It's interesting that he gave an interview with a Japanese paper where he said he would be prepared to meet Prime Minister Netanyahu under the auspices of President Trump. This would be a way of obviously playing up to President Trump. The problem with such a meeting, it's fine to have a meeting except for the fact that it's not prepared. The gap between the parties has probably never been greater, both psychologically and practically. And a one-off meeting, or even agreeing to resume negotiations that are not in any significant way prepared, pretty much will only deepen the kind of disbelief that already exists between the two sides. That disbelief is pretty profound. It is important, I think, for Abbas to show that he's relevant, because one thing that is going on with President Trump is he continues to emphasize that this is a deal he really wants to do. Only last week he said he can't think of a single reason why you can't reach agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians. I think what he meant by that, not that there weren't differences, but that ultimately those differences shouldn't prevent a deal. In any case, this is one of those challenges that is deeply rooted. We have had a stalemate since 2014 when the Kerry effort failed. In my mind, as someone who's worked on this for the last 30 years, I don't think we've ever been at a lower point, not in terms of the level of violence, because while there is violence, it doesn't compare to what one saw in the Second Intifada. But the level of disbelief between the two sides has never been greater. The cynicism about what can happen has never been worse. And the absence of even a sense of possibility, again, between the two publics, is really pretty profound. One of the favorite polls I like to cite on the Israeli side is that 69% of the Israeli public favor a two-state outcome and 91% believe it'll never happen. There's a mirror image on the Palestinian side. So it's not that nothing can be done on this issue, but I think we're not at a point where resolving it is in the cards. The question is whether or not it's possible to break the stalemate and restore a sense of possibility, which is a kind of precursor if you're going to try to work for a deal over time. The question becomes, what does Trump do with Abu Mazen? And I would say the most important thing is for him to emphasize that he's not Obama, in the sense that if he says he's going to do something, he is going to do it and he'll deliver on it. And that Abu Mazen doesn't really want to say no to him. Abu Mazen used to trumpet the fact that he, in the Palestinian press, that he said no to Obama 12 times, which meant that the price of saying no to Obama was non-existent. In fact, there was a gain in his eyes. Trump needs to convey to him that he's a very serious guy. When you're dealing with him, he expects you to respond to what he asks. He will deliver what he says he will do, and Abu Mazen needs to be responsive. This is point one. Point two is he needs to ask certain things of Abu Mazen, recognizing that what he's asking is difficult, but he can put it in the context that he's prepared, because he is serious about wanting to get something done between Israelis and Palestinians, he is going to make difficult asks of both sides. And, you know, with Abu Mazen, the difficult asks will be he needs to take action to end the financing of those who kill Israelis, or the financing of their families, or the payoffs for those who serve longer sentences. I have no doubt that given the competition with the hunger strike that is being led by Marwan Barghouti, with Hamas now drafting a new charter, trying to make itself look like it could be more relevant, I have no doubt that Abu Mazen will feel defensive, will say, look, this is very much part of the Palestinian narrative. If he does this, it plays into the hand of those who reject peace. He'll resist taking this step. But I think that Trump needs to be able to say to him, look, you don't have to produce it tomorrow, but you have to produce it at some point. Let's have an agreement. Let's have a process. But at the end of the day, I have to know you're going to get this done, because if I'm going to invest in trying to do something on this issue, I have to see that you're prepared to take hard steps as well. To take a page from what Yitzhak Rabin once said to me. Once said, I know we have to give up more than the other side, but I have to see they're prepared to do something that's hard for them. It can't be that only Israel is the one that takes steps that are hard. Trump needs to emphasize that this becomes a measure for him of whether it's worth investing in this. And this, as well as, I mean, one other step I think you ought to ask him is, again, doesn't have to produce an immediate answer, but the one other step would be that Abu Mazen has to acknowledge that there's a historic Jewish connection to the land and to Jerusalem, and that there's two national movements that are competing for the same space. There's two national identities, and that's why you need two states for two peoples. He doesn't have to say Jewish state at this point, but he has to acknowledge that there is such a thing as a national movement of the Jewish people. This is what justifies two states for two peoples. You know, this is also something that will be hard for him, again, given the mood among Palestinians. But the proof that it's worth doing something with him, the proof that it's worth investing in this, comes from his being willing to take these steps, and Trump has leverage. And the leverage he has is that he can give Abu Mazen relevance at a time when he desperately needs it. So it's not something that he should give away for free, and he should be requiring something of Abu Mazen so that Abu Mazen is in fact prepared to take some steps that can make a difference. And he can tell Abu Mazen that he will be asking of Prime Minister Netanyahu what he already has done privately, but he'll be asking him to take steps that will be difficult for him as well. This is the only way to be able to proceed. So why don't I stop there so I can leave some time for questions, and at least I think that gives you a context in which we can have a discussion.
Thank you for that. And again, if you have questions, send them over to events@theisraelproject.org, E-E-E-N-C-S, events@theisraelproject.org, and we'll take them as we have time. Ambassador, you mentioned that there's going to be some hard asks for Abbas, specifically tariff stipends and incitement. There's also talk around town that, no matter what the president says, he's going to get it 1,000 times more on the Hill where there's legislation pending and this kind of stuff. Did he make a mistake by agreeing to come, or was he so desperate for relevance, as you said, that he was really between a rock and a hard place?
Well, he didn't make a mistake by coming. If it looked as if he was irrelevant to the United States at a time when the whole region was focused on Trump, look at the way the Arab states are, then it would just further undercut him. I mean, what he's trying to do by coming is, as I said, highlight his relevance, that he has a major role to play, and it'll be hard to get anything done without him. The answer for Trump has to be, I want you to demonstrate that I can get something done with you.
Gotcha. The next question is, you mentioned that Trump has been consistently pushing for some kind of deal. In fact, he was talking about this a year and a half ago on MSNBC about how he thinks he can be the one who gets the deal. But there's also, it seems from the White House, openness to a deal that isn't the two-state solution as it's been envisioned for a couple of decades, which is to say the traditional 97% plus block, et cetera. Do you think that's viable, or can neither side accept it? You mentioned polling, for instance, that the Israelis are, that the Israeli public, for instance, would still prefer a two-state solution.
I'm not sure that the administration's real position is away from the two-state outcome. The more the administration, the president, and his representatives are dealing with the Arab leaders, the more that they're hearing from them is they're prepared to work with them, but on this issue, there has to be a two-state outcome. Understand that the more, again, the president wants to do a bigger deal, one that brings the Arab states into it, to the extent to which they play a role, which I think they need to because they provide a kind of cover for Abu Mazen at a time when it's difficult for him to make any meaningful concessions. But they also provide a cover for the Israelis, who are convinced that any concession they make towards the Palestinians won't produce anything in return from the Palestinians. So they need to be, in a sense, compensated by getting something from the Arabs. For the Arab states, for them to play a role, should they play a role, they're going to want to be able to present themselves as having produced for the Palestinians what the Palestinians could not produce for themselves. They're going to show that what they did helped to fulfill Palestinian national aspirations. And that justifies them maybe leaning on the Palestinians on the one hand, but also reaching out to the Israelis in public on the other. And it's the latter. The more they reach out to the Israelis in public, the more they need to be able to point to what they're producing for the Palestinians. So you're not going to have the Arab states. And you hear many in Israel say, look, the way for us to deal with this is outside in or to deal with the region. The Arab states won't play a role in a process where the outcome is a Palestinian entity embedded in an Israeli state. They just won't. So if the assumption is that the Arab states need to play a larger role, there needs to be an understanding that what comes with that is they will assume a certain responsibility on behalf of the Palestinians, and that requires them to produce something for them.
Next question gets back to the kind of the point that we've been revolving around a couple times now about Abbas's weakness. Could you speak a little bit to why and how he got so weak, both internally within FATA and regionally, how events, whether events that passed him or some other dynamics?
Well, again, let me put this in perspective. He's not weak in terms of controlling the mechanisms of the Palestinian Authority, Fatah, and the PLO. He's dominant in all three, but he has very little popularity. It's a function of several things. He doesn't look effective in terms of delivering anything from the Israelis, one. Two, he's seen as presiding over a very corrupt Palestinian Authority, and the more he's been challenged, the more authoritarian he's become. That's only added to, I think, a higher degree of problems that he has with the Palestinian public. He frequently seems, in their eyes, to stand aloof from them, and that's left. You know, it's not that there are others out there who are dramatically more popular. It's just that there's a perception that that the PA is corrupt, and two-thirds of the Palestinians would like him to leave. So, you know, that doesn't make it easy for him to take big decisions, but it's not going to become easier for him. And not doing anything only further tends to weaken him, or at least tends to erode his legitimacy. Look, he's in the 12th year of a 5-year term. So that too affects his legitimacy. So the issue is a question related to his internal legitimacy on the one hand. I think with the Arab states, there's some frustration that, you know, he won't reconcile with people like Mohammed Dahlan. You know, the UAE is very close to Dahlan and feels he's effective, and others have read Dahlan the same way, both the Egyptians to some extent, the Saudis. And so they're not, you know, they are not happy that he won't reconcile with him. And in an interesting way, many of them, you know, see other threats out there that are more preoccupying, and they don't see him doing a lot to help himself. So those are the factors I think that have contributed to his loss of popularity on the inside and some of the problems he has had on the outside. Although, as I said, President Trump is someone who actually can make him more relevant.
Which leads into a question that we've gotten in two or three different forms now. It's probably easiest to ask it in the form of a kind of traditional peace process style question, which is the time right to bring the two sides together? And if it's not, and what happens is that the Americans come in and they increase expectations, what are the consequences of failure?
Well, what we can't afford is another big initiative that fails, because that will just feed the cynicism and the disbelief, and it reduces even more any hope that anything can ever be done. So if you what you want to do is look for a way to break the stalemate, look for a way to create some moves on the ground by both sides that demonstrate that they're serious about wanting to do something on peace, demonstrate they're serious about two states for two peoples, and recreate a sense of hope and possibility. Now, pushing a big initiative that fails does exactly the opposite. The idea that you can launch a big initiative and produce an outcome right now, as long as the initiative is something that is focused on changing conditions on the ground and isn't pegged to an early achievement of major progress, that's okay. If it is shaped in a different way, it doesn't make sense. If it's only about bringing the two sides together, you know, like for example, when Abbas says he's prepared to meet Netanyahu under the auspices of President Trump, that's okay. I'm not against bringing the parties together, but I am, you know, I would be troubled by bringing them together for a one-time meeting. That will deepen the cynicism. That just further discredits the idea of negotiations if you have a meeting and then nothing comes out of it. Whether it's a meeting of the two of them or it's a bigger meeting that brings others in the region together with them, there have to be some results. You have to show that something is different in the aftermath of this than was the case before. So the Israelis take a set of steps. As I say, I'd like to see the Israelis make it clear they're no longer going to build outside the settlement blocks, because that's consistent with a two-state outcome. like to see them seriously open up Area C. I'd like to see them make it clear there'll be no Israeli sovereignty east of the security barrier, which means no Israeli sovereignty in about 92% of the West Bank. I'd like to see the Israelis do that as part of not something they do on their own or by themselves, but as part of an orchestrated set of moves where the Palestinians will end their financing of the Martyrs Foundation and will, you know, we'll talk about the historic Jewish connections to Jerusalem and the reality that there's two national movements, you know, that are have two separate national identities. That's why you need two states for two peoples. I'd like to see the Arab states as part of this orchestrated set of moves. I'd like to see the Arab states announce that they're launching a security dialogue with the Israelis to deal with what could be possible security arrangements in the context of peace with this, with Palestinians, but also to address what are common threats throughout the region. I'd like to see them announce as well that they'll begin to exchange trade and high-tech delegations. Each, in other words, construct a series of steps, each of which is, it sends a message about the intent of the Israelis, of the Palestinians, and of the Arabs, and their interest and their readiness to begin to change the dynamic of this relationship and to change the possibilities about moving ahead towards peace.
You mentioned the Martyrs Fund, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the you know, that system, why it's so controversial, simply because it's been brought up both by the President and there's legislation in Congress regarding it. And so it's likely to come up. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how it's viewed here in town and the degree to which there is or is not any kind of consensus, be it bipartisan, be it policy, or so on.
Well, look, there was a foundation for Martyrs that was set up whose purpose was to pay the families of those who were killed while trying to kill or succeeding in killing Israelis. There is a provision as well to pay for those who are put in Israeli jails for having carried out acts of violence against Israelis. The longer they're in, longer they're in prison because the crime is more serious, the higher the amount of money that they get per month or their families get per month. The problem with that is what it does is it makes it rewards attacks against Israelis. It doesn't discredit them, but does just the opposite. It offers a payoff for that. In other words, it elevates it and makes it something to be admired, something to be emulated. And so long as that exists, it's very hard to say that there's a serious interest in actually negotiating peace. More than that, living in peace and coexistence. So, you know, this is, it's true, you know, we have the Taylor Force Act that is a legislative act on the Hill. I'm sure the administration will support it. The question will be whether or not they may ask for some kind of waiver in there or not. I don't know what they will do. The point is that this is an understandable, I would say necessary step that needs to be taken. It's probably true that if you try to force Abu Mazen to do it in public, that he has to stand up and show he won't be dictated to. But that's why I say if the administration were to approach this, if the president were to approach it in terms of saying to him, look, I understand it's not easy for you to do, but I'm looking for each side to take hard steps as a proof that they're really ready to move towards finalizing and ending this conflict. I'm prepared to stay invested if I see you're prepared to take a hard step. This is a step that, frankly, I can't understand it if you don't take it. I understand it may be difficult given the history and given the context in which you're operating, and we can talk about when you'll do it. I need to know not whether you're going to do it. I need to know that it's going to get done, and we can talk about the modalities of you doing it and how to make it easier for you to do it. What we can't talk about is you're not doing it.
And on that note, I think that we are at our 30-minute mark. Thank you, Ambassador, for your time today and those insights. And if you journalists on the line have any more questions, you can always hit us up at press@theisraelproject.org or events@theisraelproject.org, and we will make sure that you get what you need. Thank you again, Mr. Ambassador.